2. At 5 in the afternoon, his program of popular music and talk for teenagers ended. Usually he went across the street and ate dinner in a booth in the back of the cafe with his script beside him, his notes and ideas for the dinner music program. On this July afternoon, as he finished Club 17, he noticed before the glass window of the studio a group of teenage kids standing, peering at him. Lifting his hand, he made a motion of recognition. The kids had been in before. The boy with glasses, wearing a sweater and brown pants, and carrying a binder and school books, was Ferdy Heinke, president of a science fiction fan club called The Beings from Earth. Next to him stood Joe Mantilla, very dark and squat, like a troll. Joe's shiny black hair oozed oil down his cheeks and neck, down his bumpy flesh to the cultivated fur of his mustache. Beside Joe was Art Emanuel, wearing a white cotton shirt and jeans. He was a good-looking blonde kid with a sturdy face, blue eyes, and great laborer's arms. The first two were still in school at Galileo High, and Art Emanuel, a year older, was out of school and apprenticed, he had told Jim, to a printer, an old man named Mr. Larson, who had a shop on Eddy Street and who did wedding announcements and business cards and occasionally tracks for fundamentalist Negro religious sects. He was a bright, fast-voiced kid who, when excited, talked with a stammer. Jim liked all three of them. Now, as he left the studio and walked toward them, he thought how important this was to him, this contact with the kids.
Hey, Art said. That was a cool show, you know?
Thanks, he said. The three kids shuffled shyly.
We gotta go, Joe Mantilla said. We gotta get home.
How about playing not so much of that sentimental big band stuff, Ferdy said. More a combo, maybe.
You come in, Joe Mantilla said to him. I'll drive you.
Two of them, Ferdy and Joe, went off. Art remained. He seemed unusually keyed up. He stood first on one foot and then the other.
Remember that time, he said, when you let us sit in the control room when you were doing the show?
His face lit up.
That was cool.
Jim said, I'm going across the street and eat. You want to come along and have a cup of coffee with me? Sometimes, kids trailed along with him, asking him questions about radio and music, this and that. He enjoyed their company at dinner. They kept him from feeling lonely.
Glancing around, Art said, My wife's with me. She wants to meet you. She always listens to your show.
Your what?
My wife, Art said.
I didn't know you had a wife, Jim said. It had never occurred to him that this 18-year-old boy, just out of high school, earning $50 a month, might be married. He had taken it for granted that Art lived with his family in an upstairs room with model airplanes and school pennants stuck up on the walls.
Sure, he said. I'd like to meet her.
Art's wife was in the station's carpeted lounge.
This is my wife, Art said,
blushing and with his hand touching the girl on the shoulder.
The girl wore a maternity dress, except at her waist she was exceptionally thin. Her hair was clipped short, ragged. She wore neither makeup nor stockings. On her feet were flat slippers. She drooped as she waited, and her face was expressionless. She had a narrow, somewhat small nose. Her eyes were striking. The pupils were quite dark, and she gazed in an absorbed, preoccupied way, seeing off into space. She was a rather undernourished-looking girl, but he could not get over her eyes. They certainly were majestic.
Hi, he said.
Her name is Rachel, Art said.
The girl was still staring down at the floor. On her forehead was a frown. Then she glanced up at him solemnly. She reminded him of Patricia. Both of them were small-boned. Both had an unkempt, animal-like toughness. Of course, he realized, this girl was no more than 17.
Art said, Rachel here listens to your show all the time. She's home in the afternoon, after she works, fixing dinner. She wanted to come up and meet you.
To the girl, Jim said, Can I buy you a cup of coffee?
Oh, no, she said. Thanks.
Come on, he said, across the street with me while I eat dinner. It's on me. After a glance at each other, they followed. Neither of them had much to say. They were docile, but withdrawn,
as if a part of their minds was uncommitted. In the booth, he faced them across his plate of veal chops, his coffee cup, his salad and silverware. Neither Art nor Rachel wanted anything. They sat close together with their hands out of sight. The cafe was noisy and active. The counter was jammed with diners, and all the booths were filled. "When's the baby due?" he asked Rachel.
"In January."
"You have room?" he asked. "You've got a place for it?"
"We have this apartment out on Fillmore," Rachel said. "Down in the basement."
"How many bedrooms?"
"One,"
she said.
"And a kitchen and living room."
"How long have you been married?" he asked her.
"Since April 14,"
Rachel said.
"We got married up in Santa Rosa. We sort of ran off. You know, I was still in high school and they didn't think we should get married. We told the license woman we were older. I said I was 18 and I wrote a note. I said he's 21.
She smiled. Art said, "She signed the note with my mother's name."
"We used to get out of school that way,"
Rachel said.
"And then we'd walk around town or just sit in the park. Golden Gate Park. My handwriting looks good."
She put her hands on the table, and he was conscious of the long, bony fingers. Mature fingers, he thought. Grown-up hands.
And,
Art said, "the sheriff, he was the best man."
"He even had a gun on,"
Rachel said.
"I sort of thought maybe he might do something to us, take us back." Afterward, he came over and shook hands with Art.
And the judge said,
"If we didn't have $5 to pay him,"
Rachel said,
"we didn't have to. But we did. We hitchhiked up. We stayed there that night with a girl I knew at her house. We told her family we were camping or something. I don't remember. And then we came back here."
"What happened when they caught up with you?"
"Oh, they threatened us with a lot of different things."
"They said they'd put me in jail, Art said. Rachel said,
"I told them I was going to have a baby. I wasn't then, so they let us alone."
She was pensive a moment. And then she said,
"One night we were walking home. We were walking back from a show, and a police car stopped us and made Art stand up against the wall. And they asked us a lot of questions, and they pushed him around."
"There's the curfew," Art said. "We were out after the curfew." For some reason, it had never occurred to him that there was a curfew for kids. "You mean they can pick you up if you're on the street at night?"
"Any kids,"
Art said. He and his wife nodded somberly.
"And they didn't believe we were married," Rachel said. "We had to go with them in the police car to our place and show them the license. And while they were inside, in the apartment, they looked all around, you know? They sort of poked into things. I don't know what they were looking for. Just looking, I guess."
"Well, what did they say?"
"Nothing. They just asked us questions."
They asked what I did for a living," Art said.
"I'll be darned," he said. "It was macabre."
"There's a lot of places we can't go," Rachel said. "I mean, even though we're married, they think we're going to bust something or steal something because we're kids. Like one time, we went into this restaurant when we were just married. I got my job, this job with the airline I have. I figure out how much tickets cost."
"She's real good at math," Art said.
"And we wanted to go out and have a good time, go to dinner and everything. And they asked us to leave. That was at this real nice-looking restaurant."
"We didn't have the right clothes," Art said.
"No," she said. "I don't think that was it."
"If we had the right clothes, they wouldn't have thrown us out." He nodded vigorously.
"No, it was because we were kids."
Jim Briskin said, "Didn't anybody do anything? Protest or anything?"
"When the police car stopped us that night,"
Rachel said,
"a bunch of people, they were coming out of bars, I guess, stood around and watched. There was these old women, these fat old women in ratty-looking furs. They were yelling something at us. I didn't hear what it was."
"And," Art said, "they're always telling us what to do. Like Mr. Larson, this old guy I work for, this printer. He's always got some sort of advice. Like one day he said to me, don't never give any credit to Negroes. He really hates Negroes. And he does business with them all the time, but he doesn't give them any credit. They have to pay cash." Rachel said,
"I used to know this Negro boy, and my mother and father almost went crazy. They were afraid I might, you know, start going around with him."
Delinquents, Jim Briskin said, following her account and finding in it no humor, whether in her attitude or in the account itself. Art said,
That's what one of those old dames was yelling. Delinquents. I heard what she said.
Rachel looked up at him.
Is that what they were saying? I couldn't hear. So much was happening.
It seems as if there ought to be something you can do, Jim said. Curfews for kids? They could extend that to men in their 20s or whatever they wanted. Why not 40-year-old men with red hair? Anybody, he thought. Whatever they wanted. Now, he thought, he was saying they. He was thinking as Art and Rachel were thinking, in terms of the unyielding they. But to him, the they would not be adults. They would be... what? He pondered, drawn into this in spite of himself. Looney Luke, perhaps? Or Ted Haynes? Or, for that matter, anyone and everyone? But nobody was keeping him out of restaurants. Nobody had halted him at night and shoved him against a wall. So it was in his mind. It was not real. For these kids, it was real enough. Civil rights, he thought. The good people talk about civil rights, the protection of minority groups. And then they passed a curfew. No children and dogs, he said.
What?
Art said.
Oh, yeah, restaurants.
He had not expected either of them to understand, but they had. The sign in the restaurant windows in the South, no niggers or dogs. But here, it was not Negroes. Not exclusively, anyhow.
Art said, Hey, how'd you get to be a disc jock?
It must make you feel strange, Rachel said, to know when you say something, everybody's listening. I mean, anything you say, like... You always say to drive carefully. It's not as if you were just talking to one person.
It's a living, he said.
Don't you enjoy it?
The girl's eyes, the immense dark eyes, fixed themselves on him.
It must be very strange. I mean, you must feel funny.
She did not seem able to make herself any clearer than that. Both of them were agitated, trying to put something across to him. The tension reached him, but not the meaning. No, he said. You get used to it. You mean if I fluff a line or something? Get a word backwards? Rachel shook her head.
No,
she said, and she seemed then to drop into a mood. She no longer was trying to talk to him.
Art said, We better get going. We have to get home.
Excuse me,
Rachel said. She slid to the edge of the seat and stood up.
I'll be right back.
As she went off among the patrons, Jim and Art watched her. Jim said, I never realized you were married.
Just for 3 months.
She's very pretty.
Yeah,
Art said, scratching with his nail at the table. How'd you meet her?
Bowling. We used to bowl. I mean, I knew her in school, and then we were in this bowling alley, me and Joe Mantilla, you know, and I saw her and I recognized her.
Rachel returned. She carried a small white paper bag, which she placed in front of Jim.
For you.
Opening the bag, he found she had bought him a roll, a sweet Danish pastry roll.
She likes to do that,
Art said, standing up beside his wife. He put his arm around her.
She buys people stuff.
Rachel said,
Would you like to come over sometime and have dinner with us? Maybe some Sunday? We don't know an awful lot of people.
Sure. He said, also getting up. Automatically, he began closing up the white paper bag. Nobody had given him a roll before. He did not know how to react. He was deeply distressed, and he wondered what he could do for them. He grasped the fact that he owed them something. Pushing back his sleeve to uncover his watch, he said, You have a car to get home in? Maybe I could...
We're not going home, Rachel said. We thought maybe we'd go to a show.
Thanks, Art said.
Maybe some other time, he said, casting about for something more to offer them. He said, How would that be?
Okay,
Art said.
Rachel said, I'm very glad to have met you.
It was a formal little set of words, but she gave the words an energetic push. She twisted them and squeezed them and put them forward in a carefully worked fashion, and then she said,
Did you really mean that?
about coming by sometime?
Absolutely, he said.
And he did.
He watched the two of them go out of the cafe. Art walked ahead, leading her, holding on to her hand. Her movement was slow. The weight, he thought. Already she was beginning to bulge. The dress lifted out before her, and she walked with her head down as if she were meditating. At the sidewalk, they halted. They did not give the impression of going anywhere in particular, and he had a vision, an image of them wandering along the sidewalk, not noticing anybody, not aware of where they were, drifting on and on until they became tired and went home. His meal was cold, and he did not feel much like finishing. He paid his check and walked outside, across Geary Street, and back to the station. The impression of Art and Rachel persisted, and he stopped in the front office, marking time before he returned to his job. Over the past years, it had been his custom to bring his preoccupations to Pat. He now approached her desk, but all the small objects on her desk were away in the drawers. Her desk was neat and barren. Pat had left the station and gone home. Was it that late? He wondered. Going into one of the back rooms, he spread out his records. He continued putting them in order for the evening program. With the records was the Looney Luke copy, and clipped to the copy were 16-inch transcription discs, which the Looney Luke people had sent over. The discs were canned commercials. He put one of them on a turntable and started the first band playing. The speaker beneath the turntable said, Jim put his hands to his ears.
Yes, sir, friends, the speaker declared. I'm telling you one and all to come down to Looney Luke's, where you'll get yourself not only one square deal like you never heard of before, but my friends, you'll be getting yourself a real all-around clean car you can take out on the highway, friends. And you can drive that car, my friends, all the way to Chicago.
In his mind, he saw the Kansas City announcer with his wide, empty smile. The witless smile with its hanging chin and loose lips. The tone of sincerity. Faith in the overblown nonsense. In the rot gut, the giggling, vacant funhouse face that drooled and believed. He reached to lift the tone arm from the disc.
Ha ha ha, folks, the speaker blubbered. Yes, that's right. Ha ha, Looney Luke will take that old ho-ho in and give you hee-hee on the line. Ha ha.
Ha ha, he thought, stopping the disc. His fingers slipped, and the tone arm swept across the soft plastic surface. The diamond stylus cut a path from the outer rim to the label. Now he had done it. The disc was ruined. Occupational hazard, he thought, listening to the fierce racket as the stylus scored and rescored the label. The label disintegrated, and bits of it shredded away and were tossed at him, white particles that were flung out in all directions.